baseball, Blue Jays, and more baseball. It's the walk-off with Scott Belford and Adam Mack.
This ball is crushed.
The Die Hard Podcast for the casual fan.
And another one. My goodness.
Hi, this is John Gibbons, and you're listening to the great show, The Walk-Off, with Scott and Adam.
So excited to be joined by today's guest, former MLB catcher and two-time manager of the Toronto Blue Jays, John Gibbons. Welcome to The Walk-Off, man. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Hey, my pleasure. You know, I'm glad we're hooking up here. You know, when you start to say two-time manager of the Blue Jays, I was kind of, for some reason, I envisioned you were going to say two-time manager of the year, and I'm going, damn, that would have been nice.
That would have been nice. But
if I'd won one of those, I might still be doing it. Who knows?
Hey, two-time manager is better than two-timing manager. So you got that, right?
That's right.
So, Gibby, we're so excited to have you on and talk some Blue Jays and baseball. By the way, just a tip of the hat to you, because Twitter, 10 times better now that you're on it. I just love seeing your baseball takes daily.
Was it that boring beforehand or what?
Oh, it was nothing before you got there.
Who's the guy? I thought Elon Musk was he going to buy Twitter? Was he going to buy?
Oh yeah, he was going to buy Twitter.
And that kind of killed it or what?
All right, my man. Let's start with some big news for you. I know you announced just a couple days ago on social media there, your memoirs, Gibby, Tales of a Baseball Lifer, out April 4th, 2023. Congrats. Very cool.
Yeah, it is kind of cool. You know, it's kind of funny how it all happened. And I've told the story 100 times. People going, really? But, you know, book? Or the people that really know me well, I grew up with really a book, you know? So when I was leaving and fired, whatever you want to call it, in 18, you know, a couple of the – well, probably a handful of them said, you know, if you ever write a book, the writers and cover the team, I want to write it. I'm thinking, really? That's good. Okay. And I joke about it now, but it's going to actually be a coloring book. But what happened is I said, nah, you know, because I mean, in all seriousness, I thought, I don't know who would read it because I, you know, my career's been, in my opinion, has been kind of, you know, just kind of steady Eddie, nothing real, you know, jumps out at you. But they said, no, you'd be surprised. So anyway, the time went by and eventually I got in touch with a buddy of mine that had a book written and one thing led to another. And it was kind of fun putting it all together, you know, looking back on, you know, the days in my family and primarily baseball in 40 years. And it's kind of fun to reminisce. So anyway, yeah, that'll be out next April. Well, I hope people enjoy it. We'll find out.
I'm excited for it, man. And I love that you're putting out a podcast, too. I know you start that next week, which is kind of funny because, like you said, after you finished managing, you were fairly off the baseball radar. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're on social media, you're announcing a book, you're doing a podcast. Is this like one of those just when you think you're out, they pull you back in type of things?
Well, you know, there's a part to that story too. Well, you know, when the guys are doing the book or one, it's the same group, and they said, "Why don't we do a podcast?" You know, it's like I go on. I've been on different shows and enjoy just talking baseball, right? And they said, "Why don't you do a podcast?" Everybody's doing one. I said, "So, all right." But they said, "Okay, if you're going to do that, and you got a book, you probably ought to be on social media." And I said, "No way, right?" They said, yeah, you probably do, because if anybody's ever going to want to sponsor it, they have to have some verification that people listen or whatever, right? So I said, "All right." So then, you know, I'd been on Facebook a few years ago, and that got me in trouble, and I'm tired of that, you know. And, so here I am again, and I had, you know, I always got to check with my kids, make sure I know what I'm doing, the right things, and make sure I don't put something out there that hangs me or something, you know.
Don't need to be canceled.
No. So I battle it. I've tried to figure it out. I Google every now and then, how do you do this or that? And, it's been kind of fun, though. It really has been fun to reconnect, you know. And I'm shocked at the response I've gotten, if you want to know the truth. And it's been pretty cool.
Oh, it's been a celebration in Jays Nation since you've shown your head again. Is it weird being famous in a country that isn't your own? Like, I know you might say you're not famous, but in 2015 in the streets of Toronto, Gibby, you were a rock star. And I know we even had very lucky. He was very generous with his time. Jamie Campbell of Sportsnet on the show in the off season, and he was talking about how you guys went to Moose Jaw for the sports fundraiser there. Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, and you were the belle of the ball. Are you used to being Canadian famous yet?
No, you know what? I fell in love with that place. You know, I really did it. And, you know, when my father was in the U.S. military, right? One of his assignments was Goose Bay, Labrador, up in Newfoundland. And we were there for like 3 years up there in, you know, Greenland, Iceland, whatever it was, way up there. So that was my first introduction to Canada. And I played my first baseball game there ever, you know, as a little thing. So I have that connection. And then there's just something about it, you know, and I don't want to insult Canadians by any means, but it's like, you know, I felt like I was one of them, you know, in a lot of ways, in certain things I was a lot alike, you know? And you know, I was there for, gosh, 10, 12, 13 years, but 10 as a manager and a couple years as a coach. So I was there a good portion of my life and really fell in love with the place. So, you know, I don't know if I look at it as famous, but it's amazing how, you know, you after 23 years, I think it was, you finally start winning some games. People love you.
Yeah.
Funny how that works, you know.
Winning goes a long ways, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So obviously we're thrilled you've joined us on the show, but our listeners have lost their mind that you're doing the podcast. We got dozens and dozens of questions for them. We're not going to get to them all. We'll try and get to as many listeners' questions as we can. But there was one that came up multiple times, so I figured we'd get to that one here because I want to know it too. You were the manager of the Blue Jays, like we touched on, two different stints. What changed in your personal managerial approach, philosophies, styles between those two tenures?
Better players. that's you know, hey, come on, guys. You know, I mean, you know, there's no secrets in professional sports, really in sports anyway, right? If you got good players, you're probably going to win, or you got a better chance of winning. And but to answer your question seriously, or well, I was serious my answer there, but you know what?
Like, did you chill out at all? Like, what personally changed? Was there, or were you the same manager?
Yeah, well, you know, experience teaches you everything. I mean, experience does wonders. I don't care what your profession is, right? You know, I mean, and if you don't learn from things, you know, you're not probably not going to be very good. And so there's no question that, you know, I've been through the rigors before. I knew how to deal with the media. You know, I had a couple dust ups my first go round with players and, although I don't really regret that happened. I regret that it was out in the open, you know. Mm-hmm. But as far as chilling, you know what? Sometimes the group of players you got, you know, you can relax a little bit more with than other groups, right? But it's so true. You know, the more talent you have, the better year you're having. You know, things can blow up on you, but if you're having a good season, you know, everything just kind of falls by the wayside and forgotten or it's covered up, whatever, right? So when a team's going bad, having a bad year, every little thing is magnified and everything's out in the open and, you know, everybody starts picking each other apart. So, you know, like I said, more success that second go around changed me in a better way, put it that way.
It's funny because we had, speaking of the dust up, we actually had Shea Hillenbrand on the show and Gibby, he talks about it like it's one of the biggest regrets of his life, the dust up that you two had. So in the end, you know, it probably helped him grow as a person even.
You know, hey, I like shit, you know, and I'm still rooting for him. It really, that's one of those things the way it happened, you know, he went for a few days and it was, I was looking out for the guy, right? But I understand his frustrations. You know, he was frustrated, I think, when he came to Toronto, the fact that he was a DH when he's used to playing the field. You know, we had Troy Glass playing third, but we tried to get him out there as much as possible. But that's kind of was the deal. I don't blame him one bit, you know, because he's got a few years left and he doesn't want to be labeled, right? So, but yeah, you know, I heard he's doing really good and I'm happy for that. I have not talked to him. You know, I think it'd be great sometimes, but there's no hard ill feelings from my end of it. But, you know, I kind of grew up, you know, when my old man raised me, you know, sometimes you got to fight fire with fire, man. You got to take things head on sometimes, you know, and that's not always a good thing, you know, and that's not always the best thing in this politically correct world we live in, but You know, I guess you are who you are.
Hey,
you know?
There's an idea for an episode for one of your podcasts. You get Shea Hillenbrand back on.
You guys got a way of tracking him down.
All right, we'll put you in
you
touch.
Bet. We'll give you our contacts if you give us yours. So, Gibby, you have managed and coached hundreds, maybe even thousands of players between minor leagues and big leagues by this time. And you always hear about pregame rituals and superstitious routines. What's some of the weirdest things that you've seen done in a clubhouse in the name of good juju?
Gosh, you know, they should just be able to roll off my tongue, but I gotta be honest, the clubhouse is the players, right? The managers and the coaching, they're down there, right? And I try to stay out of there as much as possible because hey, that's their domain, right? You know, I'm out there pre-games and during the game with them. They like a little breathing room. And you know what? Boys will be boys or whatever, you know, and I don't want to be a part of all of it, right? I'm trying to be a little more mature. Anyway, so I wouldn't venture out there very rarely before a game or especially, you know, when they're getting ready. So if I had time to give it a lot of thought, I could probably come up with something. But there was no, you know, really something to go, you go, wow, you know, but guys are superstitious and, you know, the basic things, the boring things, well, you know, if they're on a roll, man, they're going to do the same damn thing they did, you know, until it runs out, whether it's the way they dress or where with the food they eat. I mean, it can definitely be a little mental when you go, geez, but you know, baseball players are so mind oriented, you know, they have to be so tough minded and be able to control that doesn't surprise me that they a little bit OCD, a lot of them, you know.
Oh yeah, especially when they're on a hot streak or a cold streak, like we all saw them this Jays team just like, what was it, 2 weeks ago when they were in that offensive black hole and just couldn't seem to put up runs and they all had their hats and just like shaking their hats, right, trying to get anything going.
Right. You know, you will find in baseball now, it's probably sports all over, that it's so different. Things like that you're talking about or the celebrations with home runs and, you know, back when I was coming up and got into pro ball and all that, you didn't have any of that, you know? I mean, it was almost like you're doing all that celebrating the other teams on the other side. They're fired up. They're stewing, man. They're ready to get a piece of you, you know? But now it is. Now it's like a big celebration. And a lot of it's, you know, everybody's in you know, they like to, you know, they show their emotions and all that. And it's been good for the game. And that's kind of the generation now. But as far as like the rolling the hats, you know, they used to see that college teams used to do that, you know, you never saw it in pro ball. Now they're doing it here, you know, now with the Blue Jays with the jackets or some teams ringing
Baltimore
the bell
with the chain. Yeah.
Or putting the ball down, putting the guy in a cart and wheeling him. You know, I got no problem. You celebrating all that. I just have a problem is if you're down by 8 to 10 runs, maybe we shouldn't be doing it. You know, out of respect to the people that paid for the tickets. You know, that's my only beef right there.
So speaking of generations and just the difference of it, even your two stints of managing, the game changed a pile between those two stints. Like analytic departments around the league double, tripled, maybe quadrupled in size between those two times. How did you balance the information of both like the analytical side and of course like your instinctual stuff? And when you look back, what would you say the biggest differences between managing a team in 2006 and managing a team in 2016 was?
Okay. Well, you know, my first go around, JP Ricciardi hired me and JP came from Oakland, you know, and Billy Bean out there with Moneyball. So that was kind of taking hold, right? And, you know, of course, JP brought that to Toronto. And so, you know, you signed players that, you know, went up there and worked the count, you know, drew walks or hit home runs, right? And so that was the way the game was going. And really, I mean, what he would do, you know, the GM acquires the players. So he gives you the players and you got that kind of guy so that you run with that kind of game. You know, the big thing is, well, they made sure, well, don't run yourself into outs, unnecessary outs, like by stealing bases or being overly aggressive on the base pass, because the game was starting to turn into, you know, a home run show, right? juiced up or not. You know, it was just, it was, that's the way it was going. So that's kind of the way the game changed there. Right. But those were your, it wasn't like you had to teach a lot of guys, well, this is a new philosophy. We got to do it because the GMs were acquiring those guys as much as possible. And the guys that were just the opposite of that, they got rid of, right? Because, you know, they didn't buy into it or what have you. So, and then in a lot of ways that kind of, you know, I after I was gone, I mean, that kind of faded away, the Moneyball stuff. Right. And then, analytics really came onto the scene, and, now it's everything's numbered, right? But you watch a game now, you know, back my first go around, you watch a game in this walks, you know, guy 3-2 count on everybody. Now you watch a game, everybody up there swinging at everything almost, you know, it's like, and I think part of it's, you know, analytics says, well, this guy's going to throw this in a certain count, this and that. So they know it's coming. So, you know, there's no more, you know, holding back, you know, plus these guys throw so damn hard. You better get it going quick, you know? Analytics, I mean, both those things, it really did a lot for the game. But you could see it is different now. I mean, you can relate Moneyball to this a little bit, but not totally. But when my second go round, Alex Anthopoulos, you know, Alex was in the analytics. I mean, it was just kind of on the verge of taking over, but he was also smart enough to know, you know, the human element, right? That, you know, these guys aren't, you know, if these guys were all robots and you were guaranteed a certain outcome because of, okay, it's one thing, but it's not, you know, the human beings, and you got to factor things in, and, you know, it's, you know, every pitch you make or every at bat or every game or whatever it is, things can be different. Right. So anyway, but that really started taking hold. And, you know, once Alex left, you know, Shapiro and Atkins came in, and they were full bore towards that. Right. But I wasn't, you know, I used, and, you know, think about baseball. Baseball is always, from the get-go, has always been about numbers, right? Now it's just taking it to the extreme. Mm-hmm. And it's like a chess match, you know, whether you can move these, you know, but that's really not the way the game is, but it's added a lot of value to it. There's no doubt, because numbers don't lie. But I think it's gotten carried away to the point where every decision is based on, you know, a number, you know, math.
The guys in the khakis making the decisions, right?
Yeah. And there's been a lot of good out of that, but it's like, you know, people would say to me, well, you go by too much by your gut. And I said, no, I trust my eyes too. You know, I can tell when a pitcher's losing it. I can tell when he, you know, that kind of thing. And I guess, I mean, there's so much to analytics, and it's been really good for the game, but it drives me nuts when I watch a game now and you know, they say, well, third time through a lineup, you got to take these guys out, right? Well, I get it, but there's, you know, my eyes can also tell me that. I can tell when a guy's starting to lose it, right? But the problem with that is, and that may be perfect, I'm sure guys third time through that you got to get them out, you know, the numbers say this. But on the beauty of baseball, on any given night, it might be that player's night. I don't, if he's a pitcher, he may be a guy just got called up, or he's, you know, journeyman, he shouldn't be there. It just may happen for him. That may be his night. So you better get out of the way or something. You know, maybe a hitter, he's on fire. Your analytics says you got a pinch hit for him, for this guy. No, he's having a career night, man. You know, you'd be crazy to interfere. The baseball gods punish you. I'm telling you, they do. So, and I can remember too, a number of times that, you know, you one of your pitchers is out there dealing, right? And, you know, and this was kind of before analytics, but you kind of relate it. And he may be getting tired. You can see that a little bit, but, you know, he's pitching a gem, and it's getting late in the game. Where analytics would tell you should have taken him out an inning or two ago, right? But see, you hang on to him a little bit. But then you go take him out, and you can almost, if you look in the other dugout, I've done it a few times, it's almost like they're going, thank you very much.
What are you doing, relief.
Hey, thank you, man, dumbass. You're going to cost me. And you know what? The game flips like that. You know, it's kind of like that World Series game with
Blake Snell.
Yeah, right. Okay. I know they did it all year and things like that. And I'm a huge fan of the Rays and Kevin Cash. But he was dominating, right?
Yeah.
And the guys coming up, I think he punched them all out twice, you know, or whatever. So anyway, and they done it most of the year. This is going to be like his last start. So he's, you know, nothing, no use leaving anything in the tank. And then it flipped, right? And, And the whole idea about that is if a manager had taken a pitcher out of a game like that years ago in a World Series, he'd have been fired the next day. Right? Nowadays, you get fired if you don't take him out, even if you lose the World Series. You know what I mean? That's kind of, you know. So I don't know. There's really no answers. But I will tell you this: you're not getting a major league managing job now if you're not willing to take your marching orders to a T with what the front office wants. And you know that's not all. You know, they're in charge. There's no doubt about it. And so you might as well live with that. I think there needs to be a little more give and take, and I think the really good ones they do that.
We watched Charlie Montoyo get released by the Blue Jays this year with John Schneider taking over. But with what you're saying there, with a manager needs to be able to take his marching orders, what decisions in 2022 are left?
He's willing to take it. Put it there.
So what actual responsibilities are left to a manager at this point? Like at what point is every decision just out of his hands?
Well, you know, I don't know exactly, but I can tell you when, at the end of my time there, you know, they'd wish I'd use analytics more, there's no doubt. But I use numbers. I've been using numbers since I got there, you know, and as a kid, you know, you study numbers and all that. Now it's a little more extreme. There's no question, a little more in depth, and it has more value, obviously. But I use what I needed, what I was comfortable with, and what we were having success with, you know, and they let me do that, and I tip my hat to them. Thank you. But I also knew, you know, every general manager that's running a team should have his own manager, and so I knew when they were coming in, you know, if the team, when we started going south, and we were playing good at the time, it was hard to switch manager, that it, you know, things were going to change, and rightfully so. If I'm the general manager and I want my guy managing the team, you know, it makes things function a lot easier. So I tip my hat. They let me do my thing. But now when I was cut loose and Charlie came over, I'm not sure to the extent how they dictated everything to him, but I'm sure they did. They pretty heavy handed with that. Right. You'd have to be, you know, really, when you see all these young guys getting hired, some of them have been really good players, but it used to be, what disappoints me is, you know, we talk about, you know, experience is teaching you a lot of things, mm-hmm. right? You know, you used to have to pay your dues. You go down the minor leagues and, you know, manage or whatever for a number of years. And you learn a lot of things about the game and what have you. You pay your, there's something to paying your dues where you appreciate things. Now they're taking guys right off the street, basically, and put them in that role. And I guess the fact that bothers me, because I know there's guys down there grinding it out that deserve a chance. But anyway. I don't know the extent that with Charlie what they wanted from him, but I guarantee it was probably they wanted control of that, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty much every ball club out there now, I would think, maybe other than maybe a handful. But I don't, you know, I don't know what led to his firing. You know, usually you hear things, you know, nothing ever really got out. The team was in a playoff position, right? As far as Schneider, I knew John. When he was coaching the minor leagues during spring training, he'd come over and got those the best BP of anybody on earth, right? So we'd always bring him to big league camp. And he's just a tremendous guy, a good baseball guy. He kind of my old route, you know. I was a kind of a journeyman catcher like he is, and we both got into coaching. So to what extent he's doing it, I've got no idea. You know, I've got no idea either. But you got to figure the way the game's gone and the way that it's obvious how teams are dictating things. It's the same way up there in the Blue Jays.
So to your point that maybe analytics don't tell the whole story, I know you had a tweet about a month ago about closers and that they're just built differently. And you can take all the analytics and all the projections for getting those last three outs. But in the end, guys like Edwin Diaz, guys like Jordan Romano, they don't grow on trees. There is something different about them. What is it that makes a great closer in your mind? Why are there so many dominant eighth inning guys, but that ninth inning closer so rare to find?
You know, it's just, you know, a big part of it's mental toughness. You know, a lot of it's the carefree attitude, care less. You know, if they blow one, it's not going to eat them alive and destroy them and come back and affect them the next day. Where the lesser guy or the majority of people in baseball, you know, a bad at bat affects them the next at bat, or they strike out with the bases loaded. Some, a lot of most guys, at least I speaking for myself, that would chew me up. And you know what? It's hanging there in the back of your head. But the great, I always said the great players, it's almost like they, pardon my French, it's like they don't give a shit, but they do. Right. It does. You know, they know, well, you know, I'm going to get another bat. That's kind of the mentality of a great player. And same way with closers, you know, and the key to baseball, being successful in baseball, is you can slow the game down. You know, it's, you know, in most sports, the harder you try, you know, the better you get. You know, you can run harder, hit somebody harder or more intensity, whatever. Baseball, the harder you try, it almost backfires on you, you know, because you really, if you can slow it down and relax, because it's such a skill game, you're better off, you know. Those guys in that ninth inning, the final inning, they're able to relax more. And they, in a big part of it's tremendous confidence, you know. Even Roberto Osuna, who we had at the end, right? You know, got up there when he's 18, 19. It turned into our closer. He wasn't even supposed to make the team. He was going to go back and he was supposed to go to Double A and be a starter. But we brought him to camp. Remember Castro, right? Castro, big time. Yeah, he's still pitching, doing pretty good. Castro was coming to camp, so we said we better bring his good buddy Asuna, another young kid, so he feels a little more comfortable, right? And he's not out of place. I mean, that was the truth. That's why he was there. You know, the organization had high hopes for him in the future, but not at that time. So anyway, he comes to camp, and both of them are, I don't think either one of them gave up a run in spring training, and looked great. But you could tell something about Asuna, right? There was just something, you know, something about him. So anyway, we start the season with Castro as the closer, and he got off to a great start. I think he saved four or five in a row, you know, in some really tough games. And then he started struggling a little bit. And meanwhile, Asuna, I think, I don't know how many innings he was even pitching. He was kind of mopping up maybe a little bit. And then you could see it starting to get to Castro a little bit, because he was so young. And he got so frustrated. I can remember we were playing a game in Fenway, and he'd been struggling. But, you know, we really had nobody else. We thought, anyway. And we lose a game in extras in Fenway. He comes in, and he's snapping. He's throwing stuff, and you can just tell. It wasn't like an old veteran snapping, because he's pissed off. Here's a young kid. He's kind of panicking, I think, because he's letting his team down, right? So we ended up sending him down. So we wouldn't lose him. And then I don't know, maybe we tried Brett Cecil, who's, this is a good point to your argument, one of the best setup guys in the game. And we lost him at 15 in the playoffs. I think he was the hottest reliever in baseball. No, he was giving up nothing, right? But he wasn't the same guy as a closer. Why is that? Well, I don't know. He was a tough guy, confident guy. There's just something different about it. So anyway, we're almost four. I don't know how it. I think we tried to sooner. We were forced to use him or something. And he took to it, man. He's like 18, 19 years old. It's like, I mean, he didn't even break a sweat, man. But I always noticed, too, pitchers that come out of Mexico, there's something different about them, man, because they're so used to playing with older players or something. And they're such skilled guys. You know, there's just something about those guys. I mean, I remember Esteban Loaiza, you know, when he is there, you know, this one of the, you know, Martinez, the old Martinez with back in the day. There's just something about him. Right? Anyway, so that's my point. You know, in Roberto could blow a game. He didn't blow many of them. When he did, it's like, all right, okay, so what?
Yeah.
You know, and as a coach, it's kind of tough to see somebody. So, you know, you hear all the time, well, that guy doesn't care. Well, yeah, he does care, but he's not going to, you know what? It's going to help him in the long run. It's going to help us the next day. Baseball is, you know, thrown out for a lot of years. Well, you should be able to go bullpen by committee and close games that way. No. Well, yeah, you'd be ideal, but there's something different about it. I don't know if that's, you know, it's almost like in the military, I would think, I don't know, but I'm good. You know, you got the special operations guys, right? You know, they're different than they're all heroes and they're all warriors. They're different than your normal, I guess you call them normal troops, right? Because there's something about these guys, man. They like the thrill, or they've got no fear of anything. You know, that's
high pressure. Not everyone can handle high pressure.
Yeah, I mean that's human beings, you know. So anyway, it's almost like too, you know, you hear the argument in analytics. Well, you know, these guys that we used to say all the time, certain guys driving runs, man. When pressure that time of the game, they come. You know what? They don't cringe. They don't fold. Whatever it is, and the argument on that side is no, it's a product of more opportunities than the other ones. I said, no, it's not. Okay. Yeah. If they're hitting in the middle of the lineup for a reason, because yeah, they get more opportunities, but they've proven that's where they can be. Right. And so there's some, when you take the human element out of it and you go strictly numbers, that's what you come up with, you know? I don't know.
No, I love it. That's great. And honestly, Gibby, we're just so happy with how generous you are being with your time. I know we're down to our last 15 minutes, so if we don't flip the list of questions here.
We're stretching an hour.
Really appreciate that. All right.
Too much, you know?
All right. Well, let's flip to the list of questions anyways, because I'm sure that'll take up all the time we've got here. Adam, on to you, my guy.
Yeah.
All right. So first one comes in from Garth. Garth says, okay. What's that? Yeah, Garth Brooks, the one and only.
Hey, Gibby. Garth Orgy here from Twitter. I was just wondering, what was it like being teammates with Doc Gooden back in the mid-80s? And, what was it like to be around him and Strawberry and Keith and Gary and all those great players, but specifically Doc Gooden, because he was just so incredible in that 85 and 86 seasons. So, thanks for answering.
Well, you know what, Doc and I both made the Mets opening day roster in 1984, right? When they even had articles called the G-Men, Gooden and Gibbon, right? One guy had a much better playing career. His life got turned upside down. The other guy, not much of a playing career, but got into coaching, right?
There you go.
And, I see Dwight every now and then when they'll have some kind of like reunion from the 86 Mets. You know, I was there for 2 months and some autograph cards shows, that kind of thing. One of the best guys you'll ever meet, you know, and it's really sad, you know, what happened to him. Cause he would give the shirt off your back. He would do anything you ever needed. Right. But he came along, you know, Doc, I can remember him showing up in spring training, a young kid, you know, and he's got all this hype, right. Anyway, and you could just see there was some, obviously he had a great arm, but there was just something about this guy, confidence. It's like we're talking about closers. He was confident and a great athlete. He had everything going for him, right? It's kind of interesting story. In, what was it, 83, I was in Jackson, Mississippi in AA, Texas League. And he was with the Lynchburg Mets team in the Carolina League, high A ball. And I think what happened is beginning of the year, maybe the first month or so, he was just kind of sputtered, you know, not doing much. And the story we got, you know, from, you know, and everybody in the organization said he was at the point where they were going to send him down to low A ball because he wasn't doing much, you know. And so the pitching coach went out there. I think it was John Cumberland, a really good pitching coach, went out there one time to the mound the word I got is he told me it's time to shit or get off the pot, kid. Right. and you know what? And Doc just, whatever, I don't know if that's what did it. It's something clicked, right? And then he goes on, he strikes out 300 guys in A ball. I mean, in minor league season, it's like, and then check out, did he win the 18, 19 games? I don't know. Check out his 1983 season. And that's the story we got. You know, they might send him down, you know, because he's, and all of a sudden something set him off, right? So that year in 83, he got called up to AAA at the end of the year, and I was still in AA. And then back then they had a AAA World Series. It was a true AAA World Series. You had the, you know, International League, which we're in, and the American Association, Pacific Coast League. The three teams got together in Louisville, Kentucky, and played a round robin for the, you know. So Doc, so our AAA team in Tidewater, you know, won the league, so they went there. So Doc went up there with them. And then I had finished my season in AA and went home for a week. And they called and said, you know, Mike Fitzgerald, who ended up playing, getting traded to the Expos for Gary Carter back in 84, I think it was. He got called to the big leagues. They need a catcher. So they called me there. They called me up. And so that's when we first got together and actually played together. And I got to catch him at ESPN covering the game. I think it might have been the championship game. Anyway, can you guys still see me on here?
My phone? Yeah, you're all good. Yeah.
It's my wife, and I'm not answering the phone. It's clicking over. She's got, you know.
Oh, geez.
Got some explaining to do, right?
She's like, oh, he's probably talking baseball again.
Yeah. So anyway, that was, you know, so then we go to spring training the next year in 84. And he's 19. I was 21 at the time. And, the team had been bad. The Mets had been bad, but they had a lot of good prospects coming along, right? So Davey Johnson, manager, and he wants to give us both a shot. So we both make the team. And so I caught Doc a couple of times, and then I end up getting injured and getting sent back down eventually. But that's how I got, I guess my point of my story is this guy was a treat to catch, man. You know what I mean? He's just a young kid that just, I mean, you know, he's one of those generational guys. The league hadn't seen one of those guys in a long time, right? So, and then, but one of the best guys you will ever want to meet, you know, along with Strawberry, you know, they ran together, you know, in the New York, tough town, and especially when the team's good, you know, and they both got caught up and you know, made some bad choices and, mm-hmm. It hurt them, right? Obviously, they both should have been going into the Hall of Fame. But then eventually they both ended up playing with the Yankees and all that. But it, I think what everybody thinks maybe what Doc Gooden's been through, he'd be kind of some bad dude and blah, blah, whatever. Nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. He'd do something for you and anybody you'd met. He's that kind of guy, you know. And it was a thrill. I just wish that when the G-men they were talking about had come through and I got to catch him a few more times. You know? Didn't work. Life doesn't always slip.
No, right? It doesn't always go the way you want.
Yeah.
That's all right. Only one of you has a podcast now, so it worked out all
right. That's right. Hey, I'll get him on there.
No, hey, there
yes,
you go.
That's you should. Heck yeah.
Good one. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Next one comes in from Connor. Connor says,
hey, Gibby. My name's Connor, and my question for you is, when it comes to the 2015 and 2016 teams, we always hear about a lot of the same guys like JD, Jose, Tulowitzki, et cetera. But for you, who was a guy that not enough people talked about on those teams? Thanks.
Okay. You know who had a big year? Did you say Russell Martin?
Russell Martin. Nope.
Yeah. You know, hey, Russ was Russ is the backbone, you know, the catcher back there. And I tell you the truth, when they brought in Donaldson and Russell, every year their teams would go to the playoffs, right? So they knew what winning was. And basically our team didn't have anybody that been through, been on winning teams, right? And that's big. And they also added toughness to our team, you know, which I think we needed. They both had grit, dirty guys that played the game hard and all that. Russell was the backbone. But Chris Colabello, I think he gets kind of lost. He ended up having that testing positive, mm-hmm. back then. But that 15 season, that dude got more big hits for us. And, it's funny. We're in a playoff game. That playoff game, we lost the first two games of the Rangers, right? And then mm-hmm. now we got it at home. So we're going down there to play. And I had no doubts in my mind because we were a confident team. We were relaxed. We went down there. It was like, no big deal. You know, we thought we could do it. We knew we were too good to bow out three straight. Right. So we got the practice day down. You know, you get off, taking BP. And I can remember sitting around the cage and Colabello hitting the group, Donaldson, all the big hitters, middle of the lineup hitters, And everybody's laughing and joking and talking about, we're talking about home runs. Who's got the most power and all that. And, Colabello, he was a pretty good hitter, but he also had some pop, And some guys are hitting some home runs and he hits a home run the ball flew in right field and down there in Texas, the old stadium. And he hits one out there and it's back and forth. And it says to me something about, I got the most power on this team, blah, blah, whatever. And I might have said something like prove it or something like that, right? So then we go to that next game, game three or something. Sure enough, he hits a home run out there, you know, and comes in the dugout or whatever it was and says, hey, yeah, there you go, you know. So in the heat of the moment, you got one game to win or you go home, you know, and he's laughing. He told me, hey, what do you think, Skip? What do you think? I told you, I was, you know, it's like that's kind of the mentality of that group and the reason they, you know, they were able to relax. But so there's two of them right there.
You should have told him to prove it sooner, Gibby.
Yeah, exactly. You know, actually, he did all season long, man.
Yeah, he did. He really did. That's true. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, maybe you should have tried that in one of those first two games we played. You know, let's see. You know, on that, you know, with Stroman, you mentioned Stroman.
No, didn't mention Stroman.
Did you mention?
Did not mention Stroman on this list.
Stroman pitched some big games, you know.
Yes, and, he did.
But back then, but you always thought of the core, like you said, Donaldson, Batista, Encarnacion, because those are the big three, you know.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But teams that win good, really good teams, there's got to be a supporting cast of really good players, you know. Totally. And that was a good. And then Aaron Sanchez, man, you know, Sanchez, you know, he came off the minor leagues and then we made him a bullpen guy. Then he dominated, you know, and then he goes back to starting at 16. I think he won the ERA crown, then had the blister problems. But he was kind of unheralded. You know, Cecil, mm-hmm. Brett Cecil, we lost him in the playoffs. So he didn't get to shine there. But he was as dominant as any reliever that helped us get to the ball to us sooner to close out some big games. So, you know, it was really a team full of guys stepping up, you know.
Absolutely.
Dino Navarro, man. Russell Martin took his place,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
Yeah. Dino played great for us until then Russell got there. He limited his time, but he was big. He was big, you know, in his part-time role. Yeah, I'd go on and on with these guys.
Lots of supporting cast for sure. All right. Yeah. Thanks for that one. Next one then, while we're on the topic of Russell Martin, comes in from Jen. She says a
Baseball few Jen says hello, by the way, Gibby.
Baseball Jen.
Baseball Jen. All right.
Hi, John. It's Jen Smith. It's so good to see you again on Twitter. I can't tell you how much joy you are bringing to fans through your interaction with them. You can see behind me some of the great moments in Blue Jays history during your tenure with the Blue Jays. And so I wanted to ask you a question regarding an interaction that you did have on Twitter and regarding a former member of that 2015-2016 Blue Jays team. About a week ago, you were asked whether or not you thought Russell Martin would make a good manager. And so I was hoping that you could just talk a little bit to fans about the importance of the catching position, why it is such a vital position on a baseball team, but also if you could explain why it is that catchers, including yourself, make such great managers. Thank you very much for your time.
You know, I don't know for sure if they make better managers, but a lot of them do it, right? But I think an area that really helps you know, games are won and lost, you know, with pitching, right? You know, you can always outslug teams so many times, but the teams with the best pitching win in the end. So as a catcher, that's your job, right? You know, dealing with it, running a pitching staffs, having a great feel for that. So I think that kind of makes it's a natural transition that they're so used to working with pitchers. So when they're sitting in the dugout, although it's a different angle, you look from the side, you can tell what's going on with this guy, right? Or in my case, like if you got a really good catcher, like when Russell's back there and Navarro's back there, some of the, you know, we had some really good ones along the way, Luke Maley and some of those guys. I would always ask those guys, hey, what do you think? Or I'd tell them, hey, listen, when you notice he start to lose it, you let me know too. I'm seeing what I'm seeing, but you're sitting there looking at it head on and you got that feel, man, you're catching it. You let me know. And so they'd always mention to me, they might say, hey, you're going to come in after Doug and say, listen, he's starting to lose a little bit. And to see, that's what you can do with great catchers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then like, and as far as Russell's probably made too much money, man, to want to do that crap. You know? but I can remember now, and I always used to see Joe Torre always used to do it like at the end of the season. He'd let one of his players, like he'd say, manage the game, right? But Joe would sit in the dugout, and I think he told him what to do, and they go out and change, whatever. So after I knew I was gone, and we played the last game in Toronto, we had a three-game series down in Tampa to finish off 18. I said, So I'm going to let Russell manage this game, man, you know, because he wasn't playing anyway that final month. You remember with Jansen, those guys came up. So we wanted to see what, you know, give him some playing time. So Russell said, hey, I'd love to do it, you know. And I said, all right, but I, you know, I'm, and I said, but I'm not going to do it like Torrey does. I said, I'm not going near that bitch, man. It's your game. You and Pete Walker to pitch and coach. You guys have fun with it and do whatever. So my final day, I didn't need to take my clothes off, put a uniform on, man. I just sat in that office watching on TV and, you know, and then, but Russ, if that's his desire, you know, there's no question in my mind, he would be one of the best. And, but I, like I said, I don't know if he wants all the headaches.
Fair enough. All right, a few more to get to here. Next one comes in from Trevor Freeman. He says, hey, Gibby, big fan. My question is, in the modern game, has bunting become an impossible skill to master with the velo and spin rate? Or would you still consider it to be a baseball fundamental? And then secondly, why do you hate one-run games so much?
Why do I hate them?
Yeah.
Well, were we that bad at them or what?
You tell me.
You know, hey, and what's bunting anyway? What is that?
What is bunting?
Don't tell him to explain himself. Now, right. You know, yeah, that's disappeared from the game. You know, that goes back to the old money ball, you know, where don't give away outs. And then, of course, then, you know, as it moved on to analytics, you know, the percentages say, you know, the number of times you'll get a hit there. And so why give up an out or blah, blah, whatever. Right. And, but there's still definitely a place for it. You know, sometimes you'll notice a little bit more when teams get in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. Every now and then they start breaking out the bunt. They might not have done it all year. The only problem with that is the guys haven't done it all year, you know, yeah. So now you're calling on them, you know, after 7 months, they lay down a bunt and go, what? The hell, you know, I ended up doing it all year. that's pressure. But in the style they pitch now, they throw a lot of the high riding four seam fastballs. That definitely makes it tougher because, you know, it's a ball up in the zone with something on it. It's much easier to pop up, you know, especially when you're not skilled at doing it all the time, like they used to do in the old days, you know. So, it's definitely a lost art. Whether it comes back or not.
Analytics probably will tell us.
It's right. But probably not, but you know what? But keep an eye on this postseason, see if anybody breaks it out. You would have known 100% that they would have done it, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you know, it'd be interesting to know how many bunts were actually laid down this year in baseball, you know? Everybody goes, bunch? What's a bunch, you know? But sometimes, right. You know what? You know, then something, you know, there's so many more ways to score when a guy on third base less than two outs, and you know, you don't always need a hit. Contact does it. So it makes perfect sense sometimes. That guy on second base, you know, tough guy on the mound, tough guy, you know, even if you're trying to hit the ball the right side to get him over. Get him to third base, something might happen, especially too if you're bunting to the guy you want at the plate. Those RBI guys, those guys that don't grow on trees, man. Those guys that like this, the steady Eddies, their heartbeats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Next one comes in from Joel.
Well, it's not every day you get to ask a Toronto Blue Jays legend like John Gibbons a question. So this is a big day for me. It might just, you know, today it's what? Tuesday for John Gibbons, but for me, it's a big day. My question has to do with kind of a managerial approach. This year seems to be a year where offense is a little bit lower, pitching is dominating the league, scoring's a little bit lower. If you were the manager of the Jays, you'd come off the previous season where I think we were leading the league in home runs. You see how the atmosphere of the league changes and the offense is lower. You can't really rely on home runs this year. Would you be able to call an audible midseason and like the way Terry Francona may have done in Cleveland and go for a more contact approach, a more old school approach because OPS is so low, you can't rely on the home run? Or do you just sit there and rely on your game plan from day one? I guess that's my question. It took me a minute to ask it. I apologize.
Well, you know what the thing is in the big leagues, right? You know, the your team is what it is. The GM signs certain guys, whatever. And these guys are either they're sluggers, or they may be contact guys, or you're just guys that are glove guys that can't hit at all, right? So if you got a guy that, you know, the big sluggers, that's who they are. I mean, you know, to tell them all of a sudden, we want you to, you know, shorten up, be a contact guy. That just doesn't happen. You know, it used to be years ago that even your guys that were known as the sluggers, your guys that hit the most home runs, and, you know, even, look at a guy like Hank Aaron, right? He was just a great hitter, right? You know, like Willie Mays, a lot of those guys. You know, you know, it's funny, real quick, let me throw this in here real quick. Davey Johnson, when he managed the Mets, speaking of Hank Aaron, we were standing around the cage one day, and he was talking about hitting, right? I was struggling or something. And he played with Hank Aaron in Atlanta, and that was a year, I think there was Aaron, him, and then one other guy hit like 40 home runs, right? Davey did as a second baseman. But he was telling me, he said, that, you know, and Hank was the greatest home run hitter ever, right? And he said, he was saying, you know how, he asked me, you know how Hank Aaron took BP? And I said, no, how? And he goes, well, his first round, he just hit some ground balls. He played a little pepper with the second baseman, right? Next round, he turned up a little bit. He hit some ground balls harder. And he starts hitting some line drives. Then his next round, he hit more line drives. And then his final rounds, like, he might turn it up a little bit and pop a couple out of the ballpark. But he was always working on his hit stroke, hitting line drives, right? And then there's the guy, the greatest home run hitter of all time, and one of the greatest RBI guys of all time. But nowadays, it's different. You watch BP a lot of times. They'll have their routines, their fundamental rounds, get them over, get them in, that kind of stuff. And then it's usually Jack City, right? But what's interesting, I heard, and I thought, yeah, that's perfect. There's the greatest hitter of all time, or arguably the greatest hitter combination. But when I was coaching with Kansas City, I was around the batting cage one day, and we were playing. Jim Tomey was there. I'm not sure. He might have been with the White Sox. I think he wasn't with Cleveland anymore. I think he came to town with the White Sox. And we had this hitter on our team, Kai Hui, this big kid that had a lot of power potential. And I can remember he was hitting in the group when I was with the Royals, and we were taking BP. Kai Hui was hitting. And Tomey walks out, and he's around the cage, and he's probably one of the most lovable guys that would talk to anybody, right? And I can remember hearing him tell Kai Hui, you know, since in BP, you got to practice hitting home runs. If you're a home run here, you got to practice hitting them, right? And Tomey hit like 500, 600, 600. I don't know. He hit a ton of them, right? So there's a difference, right? You know, I heard the manager that played with Hank Aaron said, Hank never hit home runs in BP. He worked on his swing, right? Then I hear Tomey, another one of the, you know, greatest home run hitters ever, said, no, you got to practice that. That's what you do. You know, so I don't know what the answer is. All I can tell you to answer your question is, yeah, you'd love to be able to tell them to cut your swing down and the ball's not flying, blah, blah, blah. But it's not that easy to do. That's why I think the best teams, you know, they have their sluggers, but they have enough guys in that are just good hitters, fundamental hitters and line drive guys that get on base that way. Because, you know, if you think about it, you know, if the great hitters get 500 bats a year, right? In a huge home run year is what? Let's say 40 home runs. So that's what? That's 460 other at bats. We ain't hitting a home run, man. You better be doing something. Yeah. So you better, you know, you need it. And you know what else, too? It's kind of, I notice it all the time. Guys will get up, you know, you see the statistics, their stats come out at the end of the year. And it says, well, this guy's got 20 home runs. He's got like 40-something RBIs. And it's like, so he's not driving in a whole heck of a lot of runs other than if he's not hitting a home run, right? Yeah. Where used to be a guy's got 20, 25 home runs. He's probably sitting around 70, 80 homers, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, RBIs at the time, RBIs. You know? So I don't know. I don't know what your answer is. But maybe part of it too, you know, the juice ball, I think that's been a little different this year. The home runs and everything are down. So, but, you know, these guys are what they are. It's not like you can change all the time. And the game's encouraged home runs, man. You know, fans love to see it. It's proven the teams that win hit the most home runs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can argue that all you want, but, you know,
that's what it is.
Somebody's gonna throw that at you.
Yeah.
I mean, I sure loved watching Batista, Edwin, and Bringer of Rain just hit bombs all 2015. That was pretty fun.
Exactly. Hey, you know, another thing real quick. I'm just rambling. Sorry. I was watching with the game when Anaheim was in town in Toronto. Was it a few weeks ago? And Manoah was facing Ohtani, right?
Yep.
That was a big matchup. Great game. And Ohtani was hitting, and, like, he tried to lay down a bunt, right? plus he's also the fastest guy in the league, I think. And he just barely missed it. And everybody's going, well, great. And, but I'm thinking, guys on Toronto team, they're going, thank you very much, man. This guy's, you know.
Yeah. He's please, not going to hit a home run by doing
that. And he gave us an out, you know. And it's like, so there's your argument. You know, ideally, you know, he was thinking, we need a base runner and he can fly. But his strength is home run. So I don't know. I don't know who's right or wrong.
I don't know. I'm not buying any tickets to a Cardinals game to watch Albert Pujols lay down a bunt. That's for sure. Exactly. You. Hey, you know, not this year.
Donaldson did that one year. I don't know if it was a runner or two on. He laid down a bunt to get the guy in scoring position, get him to third. And he might have been struggling at the time. And I'm going, well, what's he doing? This might have been his MVP year, right? I'm going, hey, you're the best hitter in the league right this year. You got all these home runs and swing the bat, you know? But it was like he was trying, and it was kind of a mixed reception. People thought, oh, that's the greatest thing in the world. You know, he's
selfless.
What a team guy. Yeah. You know? That's the ultimate team guy. And I said to him later, joking, I said, well, you're struggling so bad, you're protecting yourself or something, or what? You're trying looking for a sack bunt. So, you know, you already got your one hit for today, so you'd be 1-for-3 instead of 1-for-4. You know? So, anyway.
All right.
So there's a big argument on both sides.
There you go. All right. Well, we have one time for one last quick question here. So I want to get this in. This comes from Ian. It says, who would you prioritize extending this offseason first? Or maybe not this offseason, but who would you prioritize extending first? Bo or Vladdy? Or perhaps Alek Manoah?
How about all three of them?
Yes.
They got the money, man. Don't buy that argument. They ain't got the money, for crying out loud, you know?
All right.
Now, gosh, I mean, sooner or later, when I say that, I mean, it is a business and there is limitations, obviously, right? You know, mm-hmm. So, yeah, I can remember as a coach and as a manager, we tell our the front office, hey, you know, get this guy, you know, it ain't my money, man. And we want everything, right? But there's limitations, budgets, what have you. But I think it's essential to the organization to sign those three guys.
Yeah.
Really the three cornerstones, you know, it was kind of interesting. When I first got on this social media stuff, I was getting all these tweets of people telling me, what's wrong with Bo? You know, his defense stinks, you know, he's not hitting like he was last year. And I'm thinking, yeah, you guys are going to a playoff spot if the game ended right now. And I looked at his numbers, and his numbers aren't that bad. Plus, the home runs are down, so maybe it's the ball, whatever, you know. Yeah. So anyway, and I made the comment, you know, just cheer him on, man, and let the front office worry about where he plays next year.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then not long after that, you see he catches fire, and he's leading all these games, and he drove in 100 runs as a shortstop last year. He's going to do it again this year. It's like, you know, it's almost like how quickly they forget, right?
But, well, now those same Twitter accounts are being like, what's wrong with Vladdy? Can't he hit like Bo?
Yeah, exactly. And then a week later, they go, what's wrong with Bo? Can't he hit like Vladdy? You know? And it's like, but that's the sports world. That's the beauty of baseball, man. You know, we can be fans. We can dissect the info, whatever we want. And, you know, so many different ways to do things. But you know, Bo, if you put him on the trade market, 29 other teams would want him, right?
Oh, yeah.
So sometimes you got to appreciate what you got. You got to look at it a little more deeply. And I get it. He may not be the gold glove shortstop type. Well, but he's pretty damn good still. And you know what? When you combine that with his offense he's going to give you, you know what? Would you rather have like that pissant shortstop that he makes all the plays, but he can't hit a lick and you got to pinch hit for him in the sixth inning? Because if you know?
Yeah,
which guy would you rather have? Now in the ninth inning, when you got a one run lead, a couple guys on, you'd want that pissant shortstop out there. I get it.
All I know is I don't want to see Bo or Vlad bunting in the next 2 months. I'll tell you that.
Oh, right. Gosh. Oh, yeah. If that happens, Snyder should get fired.
There you go.
Or the hitting coach or you know, whoever.
Clean house.
Yeah.
Gibby, I know we're pushing our luck here. Do you mind if we slide one more listener question into you?
Ahead,
yeah, hey, all right.
Hey, I'm enjoying it. You know, we can go a couple more.
All right.
All right. Last listener question then comes from Capris. It says, What should the Jays do this offseason? The catcher position, the DH logjam, the lack of lefties, more big-time pitchers for the rotation.
Yeah, you know, I can guarantee you what they're thinking up there. Hey, we've got everything you just named off right there. You know, you start with the catching position. You know, you got Jansen, Kirk, and who's their big prospect down in
Moreno
or something like that?
Yeah, Moreno, okay. Yeah.
So you got two really good ones in the big leagues. You know, Kirk having a great year with the bat. You know, Danny Jansen, you know, Danny does both. You know, he's a defensive specialist, but Danny gets some big hits, right? And, you know, I haven't seen Moreno play, but they say he's their top guy. So they I don't think you need a catcher. As far as pitching goes, you know, you got Gausman, you got Manoah are set right there. Stripling's kind of come into his own, right? Mm-hmm. And been, I don't know if he's a surprise, but he's been huge for him. Oh. You know, the mystery is
Barrios.
Yeah, Barrios, but he's proven, right? This is just kind of one of the crazy years for him, hopefully. And then Rue and the other guy, you know, if they bounce back. I think Rue had Tommy John or something.
Yeah.
So and they spent a ton of money on those guys, right? So there's not a whole lot of, you know, you just asked me a while ago, that guy, would you sign them? Manoah?
You're like, they have lots of money.
How much money do you think they have left? You know, maybe that guy that owns the Mets, he might do it. But anyway, so then DH, I think they like the way their DH works because they're able to rotate guys in and out. You know, Springer, when he gets banged up, you know, you can put him there, but you can give guys a day off and let him just DH. I think that works perfectly for him. And I don't know if there's any big hammers out there that, you know, on the market that are strictly DHs. And that's kind of, you know, I don't know if it's common in baseball. That's kind of Blue Jays philosophy now. Get a lot of versatile guys. Bullpen wise, that's what he meant by left-handers. You know, you got Mesa down there. I don't know if
I think it was lefty bats he was asking about.
How important is a lefty bat?
I will tell you this, because we battled the same thing when I was there. I complained all the time. We need more. We were, I think we might have had one left-handed bat in the lineup. You know, we were really good right-handed. But, you know, if you were a team came into town, I mean, you talk about easy way to set up your bullpen. I mean, you just got all right-handers, right? If you got, yeah. And generally bullpens, you might have one or two lefties max. So now, hey, it's like, it's like an easy day for the opposing manager. It may not work, it may not win, but he just keeps running them right-handers out. And so, I think that's important. In you know, the key is, but what spot is it going to take? You know, your top dogs, you know, or your right-handed thumpers, right? But there's no doubt, if anything, you know, it just puts a thought on the other manager's mind, you know, to have that, have that guy. But we were in the same boat, and I do think it hurt us. It would have helped us more with more left-handers, no question about it. So I understand that argument 100%.
Amazing. Gibby, we've just had a blast chatting ball with you, man. Thank you. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time. Really appreciate it. Can't wait to listen to your podcast. That starts next week, right?
Tuesday. Then it's going to be the Mondays after that. We, I think you're going on Tuesday out of respect for the Queen of England.
Right.
Because it's the day. I think it's the day. I guess that's the right thing to do, right?
There you go.
There you go.
So anyway, we'll see how it goes. You know, I hope you guys listen, and I'd love to come back. Yeah, I'll get you on my show, man.
We'd love to be on the show, man, and we would love to have you back. Absolutely.
Hey, I've enjoyed it, man, and you guys take care. Anytime you need anything, you holler, okay? Tell the fans thank you.
Will do. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott Belford and Adam Mack, with a new episode every Friday.
Osborne with a drive. Cheese and crackers. Chose to pitch to him. Wrong move.
Thanks for listening.